the book actually began for me 10 years ago. I was sitting on a plane next to a neurosurgeon who was talking about traumatic brain injury and end-of-life care, and I said, you know, I'm going to write that book one day. I'm not going to write it right now, but one day I'm going to call you, so please remember my name. And I called him a decade later, and he said, of course I remember you, and I've been following your career, and he was very helpful in helping me with all the medical information that I needed for the book. The wolf research came from a man who lives in Devon in the United Kingdom named Sean Ellis, who actually went and lived with a wild wolf pack in the Canadian Rockies. I thought that I had created a very unique character, only to learn, of course, that someone had truly done it, and when I found that out, I sought him out so that he would be able to teach me what he knew. And many of the experiences that Luke Warren has are modeled on experiences that Sean had in the wild.
Which is fascinating. I was wondering whether whether you'd met Sean Ellis first, this real
yes.
life, and he had given you the idea for the book, or the other way around.
No. In fact, it was really one morning I woke up thinking about wolves, and I'm not one of these wolf people. I know nothing about wolves. I just did a little bit of background research, and I realized that I was looking at them because nothing matters more to a wolf family than family. You know, that's what they care the most about. That, to me, was the perfect metaphor to go along with this particular book, that either you are doing your job in the family and the family will protect your back, or you can't do your job and someone else needs to take over.
And you spent, as you say, you spent some time with Sean as part of your research, and he sounds like an incredible person. What was that like?
Oh, it was remarkable. I mean, he taught me everything that is in the book because, like I said, I knew nothing. He filled me in on a lot of stuff that we think we know about wolf packs. For example, everybody knows that a pack is broken up into ranks, you know, but most people assume that the first wolf they're going to meet in a pack, the one that's biggest and boldest that comes rushing up to them, is the alpha. Well, that's not true. It's actually the beta. And the beta's job is to be the enforcer. After the beta, you will then see the alpha. The alpha is being protected by the beta. The beta protects the whole pack, really. The alpha is a very nervous, sort of wary animal whose job it is to make all of the decisions for the pack. And an alpha is a remarkable animal. It can be male or female. They can hear the change in your heartbeat from 6 to 7 feet away. They can figure out how to get the adrenaline to increase in a prey animal that they're hunting, and they send their hunters out to surround the animal one at a time until that heartbeat is beating fast enough, because when the pack then feeds on an animal that has been killed with a lot of adrenaline in its system, it urinates that same adrenaline around its perimeter of territory, and any other wolf pack that comes up and sniffs it is going to think, wow, this is a really powerful pack, I'm not messing with them. So, you know, you've got the alpha always thinking that far ahead. The alpha can terminate her pregnancy if it's not a good time to reproduce. She can terminate the pregnancies of any other female in the pack because only the alpha pair is supposed to reproduce. So really incredible, unique animal.
We're talking, if you've just joined us, to Jodi Picaud. She is the author of Lone Wolf on 720 ABC Afternoons. And so did you take all of the stories that Luke Warren experiences, because we go with him as he goes and lives with wolves for 2 years in the wild. Did you take all of those from real life? It is hard to imagine you could have made any of that up.
Yeah. Many of them, and some of them were adapted from things that Sean told me about wolves, and I could put Luke into a situation that would illuminate something about the wolf community. So some of them were made up, and some of them were based off experiences that he had. There's an experience in the book that he had that I stole because it was just so cool. He wasn't asked often to hunt because he obviously wasn't as swift as a wolf, and they knew he was human. They're not stupid, but they needed to know as much about humans as we wanted to know about wolves. That's the way he saw it. So most of the time, he was left at home guarding the perimeter when they went on a hunt, and they would bring him back a haunch of meat that had been rolled in feces and dirt and urinated on, and that was what he would eat raw for a year. Once he was asked to go on an ambush hunt, and that's all about strength in numbers. So the alpha had brought everybody to this one copse of trees. They were downwinds, they couldn't be scented, and they were all hiding in a bowl of snow, waiting to jump out and surprise this prey animal and take it down. And he's there, and he's watching the alpha reach up, and she reaches up to a low-hanging branch and pulls off an icicle and begins to suck on it like a lollipop. And then she directs all the other animals to do the same thing. So all of these wolves reach up and they're picking off icicles and sucking on them. And he's thinking, what is going on? I'm not thirsty, so they're not thirsty. I'm not too hot or too cold, so they're not too hot or too cold. And eventually he realized that by sucking on the icicles, their breath went away in the air, and that was the only thing betraying their position.
Just gives you goosebumps. I mean, I read your books for the moral, the emotional dilemmas and the legal dilemmas and the ethical, medical dilemmas, but I came away from this one with just this very new fascination with wolves. And I hear you howled.
I do howl. I do, yeah. I actually went, when I went there, I was with my publicist from the UK and my son, Jake, who was traveling with me on my way to a book tour in South Africa. And so Sean said he would teach us how to howl. And of course, when a wolf pack howls, every wolf has a different kind of melody within the pack that all kind of blend together in a symphony. And so he was going to teach us an alpha howl, a beta howl, and a numbers howl. And my son goes, oh, I'll be the alpha. And I'm like, honey, I don't think so. I am the alpha wolf. So he taught me the alpha sound, and then he taught Jake the beta sound, and then we taught my publicist the numbers wolf. And when we blended them all together and began to send out this howl, we had all six captive packs in his wildlife preserve howling back at us from a distance. It was a really eerie and emotional and remarkable moment.
Oh my God, I can't even begin to imagine how fabulous. And I have to ask you, can you show us a howl?
Well, I can, but I can't do it alone. So what I can do for you is just like what the alpha howl sounds like, if you want.
I'd love
to. The alpha howl is a two-tone howl with a break in between, because the alpha's got to listen for a few seconds to hear if any other packs are howling back. So it would sound something like this. And then it would repeat after a break.
It's so beautiful. It's beautiful.
Yeah. Thank you.
Now, all of your books, as I've mentioned, they have dilemma as a thread, and I think you just can't help when you're faced with the even less than the extreme choices that you write about. You can't help kind of to take a side or make an emotional judgment, but you manage to change sides and see each character's position so clearly. How do you do that?
Often I do it by giving different characters different points of view. I like writing in that multiple first-person narrative because it allows me to have different characters with equally passionate opinions espouse those opinions. And then it's up to the reader to decide who's right or who's wrong, basically.
So is coming up with that dilemma the starting point for your books?
Yes. It's usually a what-if question that I can't answer, something that keeps me up at night, that I'm worrying about as a mom or a woman or an American, something that really literally has me worrying. And if I keep thinking about it, it's probably a good idea for a book. And if I continue thinking about it, characters begin to pop up, and I literally hear them talking to me in my head. I hear their voices very clearly. And that's the point when I stop and I do a ton of research and then eventually come back to the story.
If you've just joined us, we're talking to best-selling author Jodi Picco about her new book, Lone Wolf. You're on 720 ABC Local Radio. You tackle such incredibly big issues: teenage suicide, the right to die, abortion. They're big ideas. Where do they get you?
Well, they all have to affect me in some capacity. What's a good idea now might not have been a good idea 10 years ago, as evidenced by Lone Wolf. You know, I knew this was an interesting topic, but I wasn't interested enough personally to write it. So I had to wait until something became, you know, for whatever reason, interesting to me. And it's probably, I haven't gone through the situation that Kara and Edward go through. But of course, you know, I have grandparents who are very elderly. As I get older, it's something I have to think about. So it is striking me in a different way than it did 10 years ago.
The research, I know nothing about medical ethics, mm-hmm. or legal ethics, but they read very authentically. I imagine the research must be incredibly important to you.
Absolutely. I like to make sure I'm getting something right. I don't like it when I catch a writer in an inconsistency, so I try really hard to not be that writer either. So, you know, I was working not only with this neurosurgeon that I met on a plane, but also with social workers and with organ donation coordinators and with lawyers and judges and all the different people who really have a role in the book in helping to make this decision.
I've read, and you can tell me if this is true, but the first line that you write is really important. Is that?
It is. Yeah, you know how I was saying that I go off and I do all this research,
yeah.
And I know what the characters sound like, and I have all these ideas in my head, and I have all these moments of research in my head. It feels like a tornado, but it touches down in a first line. And as soon as that first line hits me and I know it's the right line, I let myself start to write. So that for me is letting go of the reins.
And what makes a first line fabulous for you?
One that makes you want to keep reading. That's it. You know, like my favorite first line is probably the first line of Second Glance, which is, Ross Wakeman succeeded the first time he killed himself, but not the second or the third, something like that. And, you know, it's so incongruous that you want to keep reading. That's exactly what I look for.
You have a family yourself, and you do write about such hard, such emotional issues. I always feel so, you know, heartbroken reading your books. How do you let go of that when you're looking at your own children?
It's actually really easy because I am blessed to not have the lives of my characters. They are pretty dark people and they go into difficult places, but I have a really happy family. I have a wonderful husband. I have three beautiful children who are healthy and bright and wonderful. I so easily can leave my office and make that demarcation between what's fiction and what's fact that it's really not a problem. I think it would be much harder for me to write the things that I write about if I were also living them.
And what are you working on now?
Well, I am very excited because I will be in Australia soon to promote my first young adult novel. It was co-written with my daughter, Samantha. It's called Between the Lines, and it will be published, I believe, in July over there, which is when I'm coming. It's a book that was her idea. She called me up about 2 years ago on book tour, and she said to me, Mom, I think I have a really good idea for a book. And I said, all right, let's hear it. And she said, well, what if every time you closed a book, the characters basically got off the stage, and they still had lives and personalities different from the roles they played, and they got to live inside the book? And what if there was a prince in a fairy tale who really didn't want that life? Because every time a reader opened that book again, they had to jump right back into Act 1, Scene 1. But he couldn't figure out how to make himself seen as anything but the character he played. And what if there was a 15-year-old girl who was kind of a loner and was a little obsessed with a fairy tale because the prince in it was really cute, and one day she realized he actually was speaking to her and wanted her help getting out? And I thought, wow, for anyone who's ever had a crush on Mr. Darcy, this is the perfect book. And so she asked if we could write it together, and I said, yes, but that means we have to write it. And we spent 2 years of school vacations and weekends and after school sitting at my computer, working literally line by line, writing every sentence together. It was challenging, and it was also really remarkable for me as a writer, because there would be times that we would be falling over each other to say the words, and we'd be saying the same words because we knew exactly what it was supposed to look like on the page, almost as if we were both sleeping and living the same dream. It was just incredible.
Oh, that's amazing for a mother as well,
yeah.
To have a little protege. And
yeah, and she's so clever and smart, and she's very excited because when my Australian publisher asked if we would tour for Between the Lines, Australia is the one place on earth she wants to be, so she's very excited about visiting the country.
Well, we're very excited to have you both. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you.